We begin this evening with Alan Turing, whose tragic death 60 years ago ended the life of an extraordinary computer scientist and mathematician who cracked coded messages from the Nazis and played a huge part in Britain's victory over Nazi Germany.
What did you do during the war?
I worked in a radio factory.
What did you really do during the war?
Are you paying attention?
A film based on our November book club choice, Alan Turing, The Enigma by Andrew Hodges, is now open in cinemas with Benedict Cumberbatch in the lead role. We'll talk about that in a little while. Turing emerges from this biography as far more than a codebreaker. He was also a visionary responsible for one of the earliest designs for the digital computer. Turing was also gay at a time when homosexual acts were a crime, and his life ended tragically in 1954 at the age of 41 by his own hand. Our November book club guests are lecturer in the School of Mathematical Sciences at UCD, Evine Sulawan, science writer Sean Duke, along with Peter Arntz from Trinity College in Dublin. You're all very welcome indeed. In Hodges' biography about Alan Turing, Sean, we find out a lot about his youth. His father was an absent father. But interestingly, he had an Irish mother. Let's start by being parochial.
Okay, let's be parochial. He had an Irish mother. She actually went to Alexandra College in Milltown, believe it or not. So, I was in touch with the school and they didn't know it. So if they didn't know it now, they know it at this stage. But the connection with the Stonies and Trinity College is quite strong. And one of the famous Stonies, a Gerald Stoney, coined the term electron. And he was related to Alan Turing. He was a cousin of his dad. So, we can claim 50% of Alan Turing because his mother was 100% Irish. Now, there were people that lived in India during the British Empire days. And what happened was that they were sent back to either Ireland or England for their schooling. So she was sent back to her family called the Crawfords, who were related to her, and they moved from County Clare to Dublin, and then they sent their kids to Alexandra College. Now, it's interesting because they moved the girl, they moved her out of Alexandra College and over to Cheltenham Ladies' School because apparently...
To get rid of the brogue.
Get rid of the brogue, yeah. I wouldn't imagine there was too much of a brogue. But
yes, I would doubt it somehow.
Yeah, so they moved her over there. So yeah, there's a strong Irish connection, and throughout the book Turing talks about visits to Donegal with his family, and they seem to have come over several times over here, so there's a strong connection, not mentioned in the film, but in the book it was.
Even he was a withdrawn child, but perhaps fortunate in the school that he went to, or at least fortunate in the housemaster in the school that he went to.
Yeah, and I suppose it's almost expected now that people that we find out are exceptional in their mathematical studies, like Einstein, things like that, where everybody is saying, no, they're actually terrible, really bad at school. His grades were awful up until he was about age 14, 15, where, as you said, when he was living in his public school, his housemaster kind of noticed that he was good at science, noticed that he had an interest in it, and started cultivating that interest a little bit. And suddenly he came out of his shell, he began cooperating in class, and mathematics was the place where he really shone. So it took time, and his mother always said, you know, he'll be fine, he'll get there eventually. And that's what happened. And part of that was because he met a friend of his who's also kind of in the movie a little bit, Christopher. And Christopher also loved maths, and Christopher had an older brother who loved chemistry, and they were doing experiments together. And because Alan was suddenly brought into that kind of family zone, he started doing experiments and started kind of passing notes with Christopher in class and things like that. So the mathematics kind of interest came through that one good housemaster and a friend that happened at the right time.
Presumably some Irish connection. The housemaster was Geoffrey O'Hanlon in Sherborne Public School. Peter, even as already mentioned, Christopher Morcombe, who would was a friend of Turing, but he did begin to form, let's say, strong attachments to other boys at a very early age.
Yes, in his teenage years, he discovered that he was a homosexual, and Christopher Morcombe was his first romance at Sherborne Public School. And tragically, though, Christopher Sherborne died He was always ahead a little bit at school, and he would get ahead very easily. He got a fellowship at Cambridge before Alan Turing, and then one day Alan discovered that he had died tragically from bovine tuberculosis. Yeah. Yes.
Bizarre face.
Christopher Morcombe was really his first love. And it stayed with him all through his life. We see this in the movie as well, you know, how he names his machine Christopher. Mm-hmm. So he's sort of trying to eternalize the intelligence of Christopher Morcombe.
It also gave him something to aspire to, because Alan never thought of himself as being very intelligent or smart to begin with, and he always saw Christopher as being someone who would always get 100%, was always going to be top of the class, you know, got a scholarship to Cambridge. And suddenly, when Christopher wasn't there, Alan brought it on himself to fulfill those ambitions that Christopher's mother had for Christopher, and so Alan took that on. And so in one way, some good could come out of it, because it actually gave Alan impetus to work harder on his mathematics.
And Sean, he wins the scholarship to King's College in Cambridge, and the fact that it's King's College, I think, is interesting and significant and important. But Hodges paints a very interesting picture of Cambridge in the 1930s in the biography.
Yeah, well, you have your public school system, which I knew a little bit about, but I was amazed by the different things that went on there, the fagging system and everything like that. But then they went into the university system, Cambridge and Oxford, and it was much the same, really. Mm. And they had gentlemen and servants, and these servants were often the people that came in on scholarships. Turing himself came in on a scholarship, and it was interesting that he struggled to get into King's, because this is really where he wanted to be, and it took him a couple of attempts to get in there. So he wasn't one of these people. He was bright, obviously, and always way above average, but he wasn't one of these people that just flew ahead with everything. He struggled a lot with exams. And I think he'd look at a problem and he'd actually do it completely differently, which didn't always go down well with the examiners, and he was messy and he'd make ink marks. But the whole Cambridge thing, I think it did, as well as having that gentleman and servants thing, it allowed for an eccentric like him, and he was very much an eccentric. I mean, if you look at some of the stuff he did, you'd say he must have had something like OCD, because, you know, one part of the book, they mentioned him going around London with a magnet trying to get iron filings out of the gutter.
I thought that was so cute.
Yeah, and then another stage of the book, they talk about them being on France on holidays, and while his brother's out dancing and having fun and trying to meet girls, he's down getting seaweed off the beach in big bags for iodine experiments. But at Cambridge, he thrived, and he was a late developer in that sense. You know, he wasn't one of these child geniuses, and he got better as he went on, and he had that very big idea that we'll probably talk about. He had that at that stage that, you know, there was this universal machine that could solve any problem.
51551 is our text number. If you have anything you want to say, if you've seen the movie or if you've read the book, or you've anything you want to say about Alan Turing. Cambridge even emphasised something called applied mathematics. It would be, I suppose, a fairly familiar term today, but Hodges, I think, has to point out, because this was originally written in the 1980s, that it had nothing to do with applying mathematics to industry. It was the interface of maths and physics.
Well, applied mathematics is something that's, you know, taught in all universities, all colleges of science, or you might call it mathematical physics, but it's taking abstract mathematics and applying it to a physical theory, but that doesn't necessarily have anything to do with industry, as you just said. So applied maths was something that I think Turing was very good at, because he was a deeply philosophical person, I think, and that's why he was able to deal with that abstract, pure mathematics as well. But because he'd been doing experiments from a very early age with Christopher and his brother, and because he'd befriended another person whose father worked in I can't remember what kind of factory it was, but he always wanted to solve a problem using mathematics, and that was applying the mathematics that he came up with. And bizarrely, as Sean said, he always wanted to do a problem in a completely different way. And what was so important for Alan in his mathematics is that he always derived it from first principles. And unfortunately, it meant that he actually, you know, wasted time sometimes, because problems had been solved previously and he went and solved them again, not realising somebody had already done it. But he did it in a different way. And I suppose that showed his mathematical prowess, but also that he was able to see, well, actually, if we looked at this, the maths of this, we could do something else with it. And that eventually led on to him imagining the Turing machine.
And Peter, he after graduating, he becomes a fellow of King's College. But I think one of the things that comes across in the book is there's a sort of pervasive spirit of glorious amateurism about much of English academic and scientific life in the 1930s. Mm-hmm. So the fact that he then goes to Princeton to do his PhD, he goes to America to do his PhD, is that important? Does it kind of knock the amateurism out of him to some extent?
I think it's very important because Princeton has the Institute of Advanced Study, which really helped Turing a lot to come to grips with his ideas, especially also because there were some people working on very similar issues, such as Alonzo Church and Gödel, some of the German immigrants who went to Princeton. Einstein had initially also inspired Alan Turing, of course, already as a teenager. The American model of the university is, of course, the way I understand it, is applied mathematics at its most powerful in the sense that it's applied to industry, which is something that Cambridge, I think, didn't do the way I understood this biography here, where applied mathematics was something in relation to physics rather than industry. And I think that's what he found in North America, at Princeton in particular.
And John, the Turing machine, this universal machine that you've already referred to, what was it? How did he develop it?
The Turing machine he had the idea, the big idea was that you could develop a machine that could solve any problem, that any problem was particularly solvable. So what he did was he invented a machine, the early algorithms, I guess, as well, the early software, if you like. If you commanded a machine, you could get it to do whatever you wanted. Now, this wasn't necessarily a mechanical machine that he built. It was a theoretical machine that became a real machine during World War II. But it was his theory that was used by the people at Bletchley Park to actually build this machine.
Mm-hmm. Bletchley Park, explain what Bletchley Park was and how important it was, how significant it was even during World War II.
Well, we heard the clip at the start of our conversation saying, where did you work during the war? And Alan Turing says, I worked in a radio factory. And I think that's what everybody had to make up something inane, because nobody could talk about Bletchley Park and the work that they did there. But actually, there were hundreds of people there all trying to crack the codes that the Germans were communicating with each other throughout Europe with their ships, with the aircraft and everything like that. And so the Germans were coding these messages using a machine called an Enigma machine, which was quite complicated because you'd put in one letter, but it went through three different mechanisms and a different letter would come out. So if I pressed A twice, it would actually be two different letters that came out on the other end. And unless I had the codes to decrypt that, nobody else could do it. And it was a dreadfully difficult problem, made worse because they changed the codes regularly. And so mathematicians who could possibly eventually break the code would need so long to do it that it was ultimately impossible. And this is where Alan Turing could come to the fore. He wrote a seminal paper in 1936 called On Computable Numbers, and this is really the basis of where computers come from. And it was an abstract thought, it was like a thought experiment. He didn't actually make the computer at the time, but it was just the fact that he thought, you know, the human brain can be modelled as a machine, and this is how he thought he was going to break the Enigma code. And it worked. And he and his teammates came up with the bomb, B-O-M-B-E, what the machine was called. And they worked out a way of cracking the Enigma code. And apparently this saved at a minimum of 2 years in World War II. Mm-hmm. The fact that they were able to break the German codes from this machine that Alan Turing designed shortened the war by at least 2 years.
But they had to get hold of a German machine as well. They needed, inputs, outputs, etc., etc. They needed all of that, Peter, didn't they?
Yes, they had to get a hold of an Enigma machine, essentially, and demonstrate how it works. And they did have one there at Bletchley Park.
I think it was the Polish.
The Polish started decrypting messages already with the bombay, right? The bombs, the Polish bombs. And then Turing improved.
That's B-O-M-B-E. B-O-M-B-E. It's not the other kind of bombs that were dropping on London during the war. Tell us a little bit, Sean, about, by the way, somebody's texted in to ask, what was Alan Turing's mother's name? She was Ethel Sarah Stoney. What was his life like at Bletchley because here we, you know, here we start to come across the eccentricities of the man, the strangeness of the man.
Well, one thing the film is very good at, I thought, I saw the film too, was to show that he was a kind of a tortured individual, you know, on many levels. He had the homosexuality thing to deal with. He had the fact that he knew he was an unusual character. He tried to fit in. He tried to lead the team, for example, and really he should have been the person leading the particular team in Hut 8 that was attacking the Enigma. But because it was so difficult for him to organise and relate to other people, another character called Hugh Alexander more or less ran the show, and he was kind of sidelined as the professor, the eccentric, off doing his own thing. So that was very tough for him. And I think he often thought that people didn't take him seriously enough, and he got very frustrated. And, you know, why aren't you putting more resources into this? That this is the only thing that's going to crack this Enigma, and you must give me the resources. He had, they hyped up in the film, and I know that the author Andrew Hodges didn't like it. The fact that this romance with a lady Joan Clark, who is a mathematician, and he got engaged to her. I think the reason he got engaged to her is because he related to her very well, but he then admitted to her that he was homosexual. So that was kind of a sidetrack.
But he would cycle around wearing a gas mask.
What
was also, that all about?
Yeah, well, he was a marathon runner.
That was for his hay fever. Yeah. It was actually quite practical.
He cycled. He used to run to London sometimes.
Yeah. Which is 40 miles.
40 miles. Yeah. He felt like he'd run to London. And when he showed up at Bletchley one time, I think he'd cycled from somewhere, London. So, you know, he was very, very unusual.
But for the fact that he was injured, I think he would have been considered for the British team in the 1948 Olympic Games.
His genius, I think his real genius, was the fact that the Enigma machine, if it was operated properly, was unbreakable. Okay, there's no way, because the possibilities were too high. You're going into 150 million possibilities here that you have to. Now, what they were trying to do was eliminate possibilities and reduce it down. But what they were looking for was mistakes. Okay, that's what they were looking for the Germans to do, to make mistakes. So, for example, this Enigma had three rotors, and there was a fourth rotor that was meant to be kept in neutral, if you like a car. And one of the operators, by accident, engaged that rotor, sent the machine out, sent the message out. The British were watching this. All this gibberish came, realised his mistake, put it back into the original setting, sent the message again. So now they had the gibberish plus the message as it should have gone out, and they realised, hang on, there's a fourth rotor here. So little things like that gave them a kind of a foothold, those kind of operator mistakes. And what the Germans were trying to do was they were trying to eliminate these mistakes by having a machine that was very simple to use. It was extremely simple. It was portable. You could just type in at one end, and out the other end it came. And in the old days, of course, i.e. World War One, it was all done kind of hand by hand. So That I think that was Turing's real genius, that he knew where the weakness was. It was in the humans, and he could use that then to put into his bomb, as he called it, to find these solutions.
Mm. He should have got a knighthood. He should have got an OBE. Lots of people did who were involved in Bletchley. His fate was very, very different because of his homosexuality. Did he keep it a closely guarded secret? He wasn't particularly apologetic about it.
No, and from the book, I don't think he kept it a secret. And Andrew Hodges has done a wonderful job in the book called The Enigma on kind of documenting all of Alan's life, but actually in parallel discussing all the mathematics that he was doing the whole time too. From the book, you don't get a suggestion that he was keeping it quiet. And I don't think, yes, he knew it was illegal, but he wasn't embarrassed by it. He didn't think that there was anything wrong with being gay, and he wanted to be able to say that to other people. I mean, so he did make advances on some of his work colleagues and his friends, Christopher, as we've had. And he's very lucky that those colleagues actually, while they resisted his invitations, would never have dobbed him in. And I think that was something that may be a testament to actually he was a good friend as well. But it's very tragic, I think, that only because he was a homosexual that he had to basically lose all of his work and lose his job and didn't get the recognition for the importance of his role.
Yeah, lost more than that, and we'll come to that in a moment as well. But the personal crisis comes in March 1952. He's arrested for having a homosexual relationship with a young Manchester man, Arnold Murray, and Arnold Murray does essentially inform on him.
He does inform him, but Alan Turing also admits when he's being interviewed by the police, he admits immediately to his homosexuality, and he considered it as part of his nature, so he didn't think much about it at all. It was, he had at this time a very keen interest also in biology in relation with mathematics, so this was all part and parcel of that whole context, contextualization for him, I'd say. And So
instead of going to jail, he opts for something which, I don't know about you, but certainly makes my flesh crawl when I think about it. Just explain what actually happens, Sean.
Well, they call it chemical castration. I mean, it's been mentioned, still mentioned recently in relation to paedophiles. So they gave him female hormone, estrogen, and I think that was the deal. If you're going to stay out of jail, you have to take this hormone.
They wanted to cure him.
Cure him, right? And we're not talking Victorian times here. We're talking, like, you know, 1950s. So what happened was, apparently the GP that was tasked with injecting him on a weekly basis, I think it was, got very embarrassed. And he said, listen, I hate this. You know, he thought this was ridiculous, injecting him with estrogen every week. So they gave him an implant. And the implant was meant to work for 2 years and then stop working. But it kept on working. He hated this thing to such an extent, he tried to gouge it out with a knife. So, you know, this must have been humiliation for him, and it was all in the public eye, and you'd feel very, very sad for him. It came to an end then when he took cyanide. He ate an apple that had cyanide on it, and there's a suggestion that he did it in such a way so his mother could have an out, in the sense that she could say, well, maybe the cyanide was a byproduct of something that he was working on in the laboratory.
He set up an experiment.
Set up an experiment.
In the room that he died in, which involved cyanide. So
that's right.
She could conclude, if she chose to do so,
if she chose. And I think she did that. So that was very, you know.
Although the coroner's verdict was suicide.
That's right.
Was suicide.
And then there's this whole thing about the Apple logo. I don't know if anybody else.
Yeah, somebody has actually, Connor from Kildare has texted in to say, truth or urban myth, the Apple Corporation logo, a bitten apple, is in memory of Turing, who killed himself by eating a poisoned apple.
Quite possibly, because the Turing Award is given every year for those people who kind of bring forward computer science, and it's like the Nobel Prize for computer science, and the Turing Award is sponsored by those big tech companies. I think Apple's in there, Google's in there, those kind of things. So it could quite, I know it's a bit of a conspiracy theory, and there's also a theory that Snow White was one of his favourite fairy tales, and
that
was that kind
the
of
book,
the, Snow White, the depiction of it. So
somebody asked, did Alan Turing have any brothers or sisters? He had a brother,
an older brother.
But no sisters. What happens his after the court case, basically? It wasn't the end of his career, but it certainly made it, in terms of security clearance, in terms of any involvement with the United States of America, it made it virtually impossible, didn't it?
He had a very tragic kind of job history after Bletchley. Anyway, he went to work at the National Physical Laboratory and actually designed the first operational digital computer, which is called ACE, or the Automatic Computing Engine. It would have been the first in the world, and again, people wouldn't, or those people around him wouldn't fund it. And because he didn't get the money, people in Princeton, von Neumann, they came up with a different version of the machine, and he was kind of pipped to the post. So it was just another kind of disappointment after disappointment for him. But because he was classified as homosexual, that got rid of all of his security clearances, and he wasn't able to continue working in code breaking that area of mathematics.
He also underwent Jungian psychoanalysis. I thought that was very interesting. You know, he tried to get back on track with that, but it didn't help him in the end. That was Franz Greenbaum was a psychoanalyst.
The film, The Imitation Game, I mean, you've read the book, obviously the film, and it is a big book, and as you pointed out, Eveen, it's very good. I'm assuming, because I couldn't understand a word of it, that it is very good when it comes to the mathematics of and the mathematical part of Turing's life. But how good is the movie in comparison with the book?
I thought the movie was superb as a movie. It was fantastic entertainment, but there were problems with it. You know, there were errors there certain things weren't emphasised, certain people were left out. For example, like there's a character that isn't mentioned in the movie at all called Tommy Flowers.
Yeah.
And this man was a total genius. He was the one who built the Colossus computer. Mm. That was the computer that actually
somebody texted in that. Does the book or the film mention Tommy Flowers?
So it doesn't
the film
mention him, and it doesn't.
The book does, though.
The book does, yes, but the film doesn't, because obviously in a film you have to simplify the story. But I mean, that there's things like that. So certain people's roles are enhanced. The romance side of it was hyped up a bit, I think. But apart from that, it was excellent, because they're not going to get into the minutiae of cryptanalysis. I think that might lose the audience as well. So it's a balance.
But for me, what's so important about it is that generally people don't understand what mathematicians do. They think, you know, they sit down and answer textbook questions for their whole career. But this is actually problem solving. This is a really difficult problem. And as a team, the mathematicians were able to solve it. And so I really enjoyed the movie. I loved the period element of it. It did get a little bit sidetracked in the personal relationships. But I just think even as a depiction of the work that mathematicians can do, for me, that was a winner of the movie.
I suppose the machine, Christopher, is the Colossus machine, right, in the movie. Because he names his machine Christopher. Which in the book doesn't feature.
Christopher, actually, is the bomb.
The bomb.
That's the bomb.
Yeah, that's
so
the bomb.
Colossus was a different thing that came on the scene towards the end of the war.
Couple more of your texts. No, the Apple logo was not about Turing, according to Steve Jobs, but Steve wished that it had been. So in retrospect, he thought it was a good idea that it, you know, might have been. Alan in Donegal says, interesting you mentioned that Bletchley had an Enigma machine. No British review I have read or heard mentions that salient fact. Is it, he has a question about the film. I'm not quite sure exactly what. I mean, as far as I'm aware, I remember interviewing Lady Kilannon, who was in Bletchley, and she certainly talked about the Enigma machine.
Oh yeah, they had machines.
They had a machine.
I think it was
from a German submarine.
Yeah, right, but that didn't necessarily solve their problem, because they still had a lot of work to do. Just looking at the machine wasn't enough. Obviously, they had to know what the settings were and lots of other things.
Yeah. So there was still a lot of work to be done, even though they got the actual machine. Thank you all very, very much indeed for joining us and for reading the book for us. Incidentally, I'm sure you're aware of the fact, but in 2009, following an internet campaign, British Prime Minister Gordon Brown made an official public apology on behalf of the government for the appalling way Turing had been treated. I think she got a posthumous knighthood as well. He was given a posthumous pardon by the Queen. I think she could definitely go one better.
A
bit weak. Alan Turing, The Enigma by Andrew Hodges, is published in paperback by Vintage. The Imitation Game, the movie based on his life, is now in cinemas nationwide.